On the broadcast today, corporate America and how it is going to handle the new politics of this economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, February the 1st. Glad to have you with us, as always, everybody. I discovered maybe the best ever ticker symbol today. HOG, H-O-G, for Harley-Davidson, of course, after the nickname for their bikes. No, I don't know how I didn't know about that before. Shares off about 0.8% on a disappointing quarterly profit report. A big drop in motorcycle sales seems to be the proximate cause. The company is in the news, though, for another reason as well, for something that is not happening. There had been reports pushed back against by the White House, it must be said, that a visit by President Trump to the Harley factory in Milwaukee had been canceled because the company was worried about protests. Fact is, it used to be easy for corporate America to stay away from politics. Now, much far less so, with the White House willing to call companies and industries out directly on Twitter or in a summons to Washington, while at the same time those companies having to risk alienating their own consumers who feel strongly about Trump one way or the other. So Marketplace's Mariel Segarra gets us going with this story about corporate America caught between a rock and a hard place.
In the face of a political onslaught, the best way a company can respond is by being true to its brand. Starbucks, for instance, came under fire this week for saying it would hire 10,000 refugees after President Trump issued his travel ban. Mary Hunter McDonald teaches management at the Wharton School.
That's not going to hurt Starbucks. So the people that are buying Starbucks products know what Starbucks is about, and they're not going to be dissuaded from supporting Starbucks by Donald Trump.
Companies should already be strategizing about how to react if their products or industries end up in the political spotlight. Terrence Lau is a professor at the University of Dayton School of Business Administration.
If the president tweeted against your company today, would you know how to respond? Would you know who to call? The best companies are going to have a response already pre-approved.
That's because policy is coming from the White House at a breakneck pace. Dan Simon is CEO of Vested.
20 years ago, corporations, even in those sort of classic public relations crises, had days to think about what their position should be. Today, this stuff can happen in a matter of hours.
Terrence Lau from the University of Dayton says there's one surefire way for companies to stay above the fray.
You know, talk about American values, not about political values. American values include freedom and diversity and respect for other people and civility.
If that doesn't work, they can talk about something less contentious, like the Patriots-Falcons matchup this weekend. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This was, in addition to some cabinet votes, regulation rollback day on Capitol Hill. The GOP began a series of votes in the House to undo regulations on energy and the environment, one on coal pollution, one on oil and gas emissions. We, though, will focus here on an anti-corruption measure in the fossil fuel industry. It obliges oil and gas companies and mining firms to disclose how much money they pay foreign governments. Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one from our sustainability desk.
Several studies suggest the extractive sector, oil and gas and mining, is the most corrupt in the world. That's because a whole lot of money is often paid to a single party, a foreign government, says UCLA political scientist Michael Ross. He gives the example of Equatorial Guinea.
The president, Obiang, has skimmed off billions of dollars in oil revenues, much of it going to crazy luxuries. You know, his son bought Michael Jackson's famous glove.
5 years ago, the U.S. sought to shine light on those deals. It required companies listed on American exchanges to disclose payments to foreign governments. The EU passed similar rules, as did Norway and Canada, in all covering 84 of the 100 biggest oil companies. But the U.S. oil lobby always fought it, arguing it's unfair to disclose if others don't. On the House floor today, Republican Congressman Ken Buck of Colorado made their case.
We also cannot stand for regulations that place American companies at a disadvantage. When we repeal this unwise regulation on American energy companies, they can again fully contribute to the world's energy economy.
The repeal vote passed. It's a bitter defeat for anti-corruption groups like the Natural Resource Governance Institute. President and CEO Daniel Kaufman now sees an irony.
Russian, even state-owned companies are more transparent and disclosing more than the U.S. big oil companies.
The vote now moves to the Republican Senate. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Not for nothing, but the Federal Reserve wrapped up a meeting on interest rates today. I mean, you know, they didn't do anything, but I figured at least I should mention it, right? Wall Street today, modestly higher. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Jobs, manufacturing, and bringing them back was pretty much the economic trifecta for the Trump campaign last year. Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, is in Dalton, Georgia, reporting this week to get a baseline on those promises here in the early days of the Trump administration. Hey, Lizzie.
Hi, Kai.
Why are you in Dalton, Georgia, pray tell?
Well, for, I guess, the past 2 years, I've been talking to three different mayors around the country who all live in different places, cities around the same size of the 30,000-person range, with really different economies. And Dalton is a manufacturing town, largely. So we came here to actually meet the mayor in person who we've been talking to for the past 2 years and get a sense of the community and get a sense of how their manufacturing business, which is carpet, has changed. I should tell you, I'm sitting on the 50-yard line of a AstroTurf football field that was made here in Dalton. They, you know, carpet business doesn't just make carpet. They make turf, they make floors, they make all that stuff.
Oh, well, that's excellent. So tell me, actually, as long as we're talking about carpet, one of the themes of our coverage and your coverage and the stuff we've been doing is how manufacturing in this country is changing. So talk to me for a second about a town like Dalton and what they're going through.
So there are a couple of things. We spent part of our morning at a cafe and talked to some gentlemen who've lived here for a really long time. And they were saying there used to be, you know, 200 different carpet companies in Dalton. And it was hard manual labor. We've also been driving around with the mayor. And I want to sort of play what he said because it encapsulates how this has moved really from more of a manual labor industry into one that requires a lot of computer and tech skills. Here is the mayor of Dalton, Dennis Mock.
Carpet's not the manual labor type position that it used to be. It involves computers and it involves math and it involves chemicals and it involves a whole lot of technical things that we're really having to catch up and push people into that. And it takes less people to do the same job.
Hmm. Who's doing the work, though, in these factories right now?
Well, one of the things that I think is interesting and might surprise some people about a town in northwest Georgia is that this town is almost 50% Latino. A lot of families came largely from Mexico to work in the carpet industry in the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. And we met some of them, but we also met their kids who are at places like Dalton State. We sat with a group of five students who were all kind of student leaders and talked to them. Some are really attached to Dalton. Some want to leave and go away. I want to play you a piece of tape from Laura Lee Quecho. She's 26. She is from Valencia, Spain, and she's a DACA student. She's a dreamer, and she said she wanted people to know that, and she's sort of trying to balance her love of Dalton and Dalton State with policies under the new administration that may be difficult for her.
Am I scared? Yes and no. I know what I believe and I know what I stand for and I know what I'm capable of. So I know that if he makes like the decision of, you know, taking us all out, I know that through my education, I'm going to shine wherever I go.
Hmm. So do me a favor, Lizzie, and step back for a minute, right? Because North Georgia went hard for Donald Trump. As you say, Dalton has a 50% Latino population. What are they looking for then coming out of that cut from the new president and the promises he's made?
I think they're looking for a bunch of different things. The business community that we have talked to, they're very interested in fewer regulations, and they are, I would say, in general, a very limited government crowd. I mean, one of the things that was interesting, the mayor drove us out to an area that he is working on developing as kind of a wildlife area, a reservoir where people can kayak and fish. And he said, well, I'm a small government guy. And I was like, come on, Dennis, this is the government. You're doing this, making this thing. but, you know, that's not how he sees his role. And in fact, one of the interesting things about Dalton is low wages are an issue here, but they are a very free market town. He does not see, any sort of local or municipal or even state minimum wage being something that they'd want here.
Marketplace's Lizzie O'Leary, the host of our weekend program in Dalton, Georgia. She's been talking to the mayor and a bunch of folks there. Stories what, this weekend, next weekend? When are you going to put them on?
A little bit this weekend and probably a lot more next weekend.
All right. Tune in. Lizzie, thanks.
All right. Thanks.
This is going to sound a little harsh, but higher education and the academic economy is, in a lot of ways, a business. A business that right now is concerned about last week's travel ban from the White House. At last check, more than 5,000 scholars have signed an open letter calling for the boycott of international academic conferences being held in the United States. Marketplace's Andy Euler has that story.
The ban was intended to keep terrorists out of the U.S., but it's left some students and scholars with valid visas stranded outside the country. Others complain it's left them feeling stuck here. Meherzad Bourouj-Eradi is chair of the political science department at Syracuse University. He's been working for 10 months on getting an Iranian scholar to join his staff and teach Iranian politics to students at Syracuse.
I managed to secure an outside grant for him, plus came up with university funds to match it. And now, thanks to this executive order, this whole enterprise has been called into question.
He says the scholar he wanted to bring in has been jailed in Iran as a political dissident and is exactly the sort of person who'd be able to explain what's happening in Iran to Americans and make this country safer. Daniel Serwer agrees. He's a professor of conflict management at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies.
We've shot ourselves in the foot.
He says data he's seen implies a travel ban won't directly affect terrorism. And
it's not just people from the seven countries who are not going to travel. A lot of other people are going to feel inhibited from traveling as well.
And then there are those boycotting travel to the United States. Thousands of academics have pledged to skip conferences here because of the order. Beth Barron is president of the Middle Eastern Studies Association.
Academic conferences are also a business. Associations depend on the annual conferences for a good deal of their support.
She says that's where almost half of the association's operating budget comes from. And now, its leaders are considering moving this year's conference outside of the U.S. But many U.S.-based Middle Eastern studies scholars come from one of the seven banned nations. They've got visas to work here, but they'll probably think twice about leaving for fear they wouldn't be allowed back in. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Because I just don't believe the purpose of life is money.
Yeah, but life is complicated. First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials up 26 points today, about a 10% on the blue chips, closed at 19,890. The NASDAQ up 27 points, about a 0.5%, 56.42. The S&P 500 gained less than a point, remaining essentially unchanged, 22.79. As I mentioned earlier, no surprise at all that the Federal Reserve decided to leave interest rates unchanged. The Fed did note, I should add, though, that inflation is rising. So with that, a look at banks that, of course, watch interest rates closely. Bank of America deposited 1.1%. Goldman Sachs up about a 0.5%. J.P. Morgan Chase rose 0.33% today. Apple said it's been ringing up sales of the iPhone 7 in the last quarter. Apple dialed in 6.1% today. Samsung, which had to recall those Galaxy 7 phones after some caught fire, power down 0.8%. Amazon, Expedia, and Microsoft are all based in Washington State, and they have said, those companies have, that they will help their home state with its legal challenge to President Trump's travel ban. Thus, Amazon delivered 1%. Today, Expedia drifted 0.2%. Microsoft off about 1.6%. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey, everybody, Molly here.
It's Kai, but you already knew that.
You did. But we have something that we would like to tell you together.
We are doing a new podcast. It's called Make Me Smart, about the things we want to know more about but don't always have time to dig into on this daily program.
Yeah, and it's about you too, the things that you want to know more about and the things that you're an expert on. We'd like to have you on the show too.
And mostly it's me and Molly having fun. Check us out at marketplace.org/makemesmart. There's lots more info there.
And please subscribe on iTunes or wherever you podcast.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. One of the things that happens with news is that stories play differently here than they do overseas. With that in mind, we've called Borzu Deragahi. He's the Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News based in Istanbul to get a sense of the economic implications of the White House travel ban as seen from over there. Borzu, welcome to the program.
Always a pleasure.
Give me the big picture first, would you, and some sense of how this ban looks from overseas.
Well, I think that for a large part, many people in the Middle East and the broader Muslim world, based on my reporting and reading of the local press in these countries, you know, they see it as a, you know, kind of a discrimination against them, as a discriminatory and a sort of example of the what they would consider the rising Islamophobia in the West. So it's definitely perceived that way.
Do you hear or read or talk to people who say, you know what, I'm just not even going to bother going to the States. I don't want to do business over there. I don't want to try to go to school there. I don't want to invest. Just the heck with them.
I hear that a lot, and I've been hearing that for a few years now, and that's going to intensify right now. As a matter of fact, I you know, was looking at reports in U.S. News outlets as well as other news outlets about India, China, Malaysia, Indonesia, institutions in these countries, including schools, tour operators, and you know, investor. What do you call that? Chambers of commerce. Mm-hmm. Seeing this as an opportunity, it's like, hey, if you're a rich dude and or lady and you want to invest, if you're a promising student, you want to study, if you're looking for a vacation, don't go to the U.S., forget them, come visit us, come here and spend your money here. So I already people are exploiting this. People that we should consider U.S. economic rivals are exploiting the visa ban to make bank.
When you go out for a cup of coffee or whatever on the corner there in Istanbul, is this a topic of conversation?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, Trump is Trump and his policies and his administration are front and center here. It's constantly on the television. People are talking about it. It's in the front pages of newspapers. And officials who, in Turkey at least, were rather welcoming to the Trump administration, rather disillusioned by the administration of Barack Obama. Even they, in the last few days, have begun to speak out, prominent voices in the government condemning the visa ban, seeing it as a, as I was saying, a sort of message to the broader Muslim world, including to Turks, which are also an essential ally in the fight against ISIS, a NATO partner, and you know, the host of a massive U.S. airbase that's mm-hmm. crucial to U.S. operations in this part of the world.
Borzu Deragahi is in Istanbul, Turkey. He's the Middle East correspondent for BuzzFeed News. Borzu, thanks.
It's a pleasure.
Sometimes when you schedule an interview, it takes a while. And when you finally get it set up, the news of the day lines up pretty well with what you wind up talking about, which is a pretty good start to today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Peter Kim is the guest today. He's the founder and CEO of Hudson Jeans. It's what's called a premium denim company based here in Los Angeles. Peter, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up in the garment business.
Yes.
Tell me the story.
So I'm born and raised in L.A.
Yeah.
Both my parents are from North Korea. North Korea. They became refugees into the South.
Yeah.
And so they grew up incredibly poor. And in the early 60s, they ended up immigrating out to the U.S., American Dream, and so forth. So I came to L.A. They saved their money. They started an apparel company, Missy Moderate Career, Missy Moderate Polyester Blouses. And
there are people in fashion who will know exactly what that means. Yeah.
And it's very niche, but they had an incredible run at it because, you know, you have the 80s come around, working women, dual income, respected. They made a ton of money, invested on the real estate. And then the 90s come around. We had over $10 million in debt. Interest rates back in the, you know, the early 90s were, I think we're paying like 12, 13%.
Yep.
And at the same time, the workwear environment changed. And so their product and their business became irrelevant. You know, there was, you know, Dress on Fridays, basically 20% of the work week is gone.
So you're in business school at USC and one day the phone rings.
It's spring break. Yeah, it's my dad's spring break. I'm sleeping in. He's like, what are you doing? I'm like, I'm sleeping. And he's like, you need to get dressed down here like now and help out. I'm like, God, Dad, come on. And so I got thrown into the mix real fast.
Did you know what you were doing?
No. And the way I processed it was, okay, it's not ideal. It's a bit difficult. But my parents came from the north to the south to this country with zero, absolutely nothing. And they've created something here that's pretty amazing. If that's possible, maybe this is possible as well. But at the very least, it's a honorable, noble death. So that was an attitude that we took.
From the family business, you start your own company called Jane's Army.
That was my first run of premium denim.
Which doesn't go so well.
The beginning was great. We blew up out of the scene because it was in 2000, so super early on the premium denim side. This thing takes off, but then we're making it in Thailand. The whole category's new. We ended up couldn't control quality, couldn't control deliveries. Basically, the product was not what we thought it was going to be.
Right.
We shipped it anyways. Thinking, okay, maybe we have a shot,
which was a huge
mistake.
So you learned that lesson.
Yeah, real quick. End up shutting the company down because I'm like, okay, this is too, we might as well restart.
So what made you then, after Jane's Army and the failure, mm-hmm. right, of that
absolutely.
Company, right?
Absolutely.
Why did you want to get back into premium denim?
This is, I found this passion in premium denim because... The money part, the success part for me, the success has not much to do with the money part. And I understand the money part's important. It is a necessity and it's really important. But what I always believe is the money isn't what defines me. It is a product of doing something, hopefully really well, that's impactful, that affects lives. And if you can do that, then because I just don't believe the purpose of life is money.
Okay, but... Right. I mean, I get all that. And I totally understand where you're coming from. But here you are selling blue jeans for $150 or $300 a pop.
Right. Right.
Help me.
How to define it?
Yeah. So, help me make sense of that with your ethos.
So it's not something that we make for dirt cheap and sell it for, you know, $200. All of our denim is coming out of either Italy or Turkey, out of these premium mills that they produce top quality fabric. And a lot of people may not know or know is denim is something that's very different than most apparel products.
How come?
It's very unstable.
You mean the actual denim, the fabric bolt
itself.
Of denim fabric?
Yeah,
the fabric itself,
just to start with that, and it's just unstable. So each roll could possibly have different characteristics from roll to roll, even in the same exact style, if you will.
So you have to have people opening the rolls, cutting them, matching,
testing them,
wash
shrinkage, and so forth.
Right.
Every single roll to create consistency. It's something that, you know, we're fanatical about quality.
Can I ask you a geopolitical question here for a minute? You do some assembly and processing work in Mexico, right?
We do a lot now.
So here we are in the Trump administration.
Yeah,
and the Mexican trade relationship is very much on the table. How much of a pain is that going to be for you?
I don't know. You know, one of the things we started our career in the company, we were producing 100% in L.A. And it was possible back in, you know, 2003 or so. Over time and more recent times, it's become almost impossible to produce in L.A. and still maintain reasonable pricing. It's just, you know, between minimum wage and healthcare and energy and so forth and so forth, it's getting to a point where to produce it here, the prices, when it finally hits retail, it would be like 30, 40% higher.
Right. So now you're a guy Conceivably, the president of the United States could tweet tomorrow about Hudson Jeans and say, Hudson Jeans is not going to get its product into the United States without a 30% tariff.
Yeah.
Right?
It's possible. It's very possible. That would probably have a huge hit to premium denim in general. Not just for us.
Yeah, not just you, but
in general. Because, you know, we're looking all over the place to see where we can have the best quality and still have the proper pricing. And with the newest wrinkle, I guess, we'll just have to relook at what's going to happen and what are the possible outcomes of whatever he's going to implement.
Peter Kim, the company is Hudson Jeans. Peter, thanks a lot for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It was enjoyable.
We talked a good long while, Peter Kim and I did. The rest of the conversation is on our Corner Office podcast. This final note on the way out today, there is no, repeat, no bacon shortage in America. Some of you might have seen stories saying that there is rocketing around the internet today, complete with a baconshortage.com website. Yes, inventories of frozen pork bellies are down, and yes, bacon prices are up just a bit. But to quote a pork economist, there are plenty of hogs on the way, and baconshortage.com is just good marketing. Credit where credit's due. The New York Times did the debunking on that one. All right, we got to go. The Dow up about 26 points today, a 10%. The NASDAQ up 27 points, a 0.5%. S&P 500 basically flat. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tolliday. Engineer the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.